Hi, podcast listeners. It's Doug Fabrizio here. A while back, we talked with a psychiatrist and researcher, Bessel van der Kolk. He's an expert on treating and exploring trauma, how sexual or physical abuse or war affects the human body. And the insight that gave van der Kolk recognition and acclaim is this idea that trauma literally reshapes the body and brain. He says we store trauma in our bodies. It messes with the alarms in our nervous system, for example. It short-circuits the part of the brain that communicates what van der Kolk describes as the embodied feeling of being alive. So part of the treatment he recommends is that victims allow their bodies to have these positive experiences. He wants them to get back into their bodies. So yoga is a treatment. Dancing. Martial arts is too. And this is what helped heal Michelle Simone. She's a therapist in California, and her way back into her body was the practice of Aikido.
I had a lot of physical and sexual abuse, and I had two parents that had a lot of their own trauma and really didn't know quite how to keep their children safe. So by the time I was 12, I was already kind of having suicidal thoughts. And by high school, I was already starting to run away from home. And then I ended up going to a university here, to Cal Poly State University, and had a really hard time. I self-medicated with drugs and alcohol to cope with my trauma. Ended up in therapy. I was very depressed. But I had a friend that took me to a self-defense class. And these were two Aikido teachers that were teaching self-defense. And they were just so human. And so I got to reconnect with vulnerability and what does it mean to be in a group of people that acknowledge trauma. And it's, oh, it's safe here. A new world started to open up. From being shut down, depressed, numbed out, to within a month or two, I shifted into, I want to hurt somebody. I went to, like, because I had so much pent up energy for decades of feeling helpless and powerless and kind of like pretty frozen. So I went to this other state of a lot of energy, and they helped me work with that in a way that I could express fully and discharge it in safe ways with other people, because trauma happens in relationship and healing happens in relationship. So within the context of this class that eventually shifted into Aikido, I got to express the pain and people were able to hear it. People had my back and I got to express it through my body and through my voice over and over again. And it's almost like this team of people walked with me through it. And it was a dark kind of journey, but we did it all together and it was very empowering. So I went from self-defense, which is I'm not going to tolerate people touching me in a way that isn't safe, to having the capacity to be in a class with people where there was boundary grounded touch that was also with empathy and understanding. So you could have both. To me, that's a whole nother level than just self-defense. Trauma lives in the body. So the physical expression really allows the body to complete a whole variety of incomplete responses, such as, no, don't ever touch me again. Now, safety, I used to need it to be on the outside as a kid, and then in that self-defense class, they created a safe environment, but now safety starts from the inside out. It doesn't need to be completely required to be on the outside in order for me to feel safe.
This is Radio West. Our conversation with Bessel van der Kolk was over Zoom. So to preserve the bandwidth, we usually ask guests to turn off the video. But since human connections, touching and seeing people is important to his ideas and his treatment, van der Kolk insisted on seeing me while we talked. We talked about trauma, of course, but also the Capitol riot in January and the effect of COVID on connection and touch. We started, though, with another story. When Bessel was a young man, He went to work for the VA, and he met a patient named Tom.
I was fascinated by what I saw. What I saw was a lot of men who were about my age, who in some ways I was a little jealous of. They were very competent, very good with their hands. They were very athletic. They were very skilled in mechanical stuff. And so while I met these very competent people, something had been broken in them. And that brokenness really just struck me. And Tom was one of these smart people, come back from Vietnam, goes to law school, and he had just spent the weekend in his law office, 4th of July weekend, holed up, getting drunk. He was still drunk when he came to see me. And he said, I can't go home because I cannot be trusted. I blow up at people. I don't feel anything. I get nervous. I sleep on the living room couch. I cannot sleep. And so I focused on a sleep problem and gave him some pill to make the sleep problem go better. And he came to see me a week later. And I said, so how was it? Expecting him to say, you're a wonderful doctor. Thank you so much. Instead of it, he said, I didn't take your pills. And I said, why not? He said, you know, I realized that if I stop having my nightmares, my friends will have died in vain. I need to be a living memorial to my friends who died in Vietnam. And that statement just blew my mind. I'm a biologist. I'm a neuroscientist. You know, we like to reduce things to very simple things. And what this guy told me about is that his love and care for his friends from Vietnam got him to have to replay their death over and over again. And what's even more striking is that his father had fought with Patton in the Battle of the Bulge, which occurred about 100 miles from where I was a baby at that particular time. So it meant something to me. And his father was in this heavy battle in Christmas 1944, and he came home, and all his father would talk about was the war. And what he told my patient is that the only people who will ever love were his friends who died in the Second World War. And here's his son, and it turns out the only person he's going to love are the people who died in Vietnam. And I thought, this is about love, this is about affiliation, it's about people's heart being broken, and it's clearly something happens in the brain, and it's about loyalty, it's about people's feeling of belonging, people's connection. And so I got really very intrigued by how all of these different pieces of being a human being can really come together with trauma and really keep you stuck on the past and keep you from going on with your life, basically.
I'm interested about the part where you said that you realized it was much more about just systems and organisms, but as you put it in the book, about the mind and about love.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the love part. That's really interesting. You were seeing this, the emotional part connected to the biological part, which maybe wasn't so thought of so much.
What the guy talked about is that his own dad didn't love him. And what he talked about also is that he couldn't love his own kids. He showed me the pictures of his own kids. He said, I know they're cute kids, but my heart isn't open to them. I don't feel anything for them. And so clearly something had broken. And then when he talked about his friends who died in Vietnam, there was a great deal of love in his voice. And then later, around that time, I started to do groups of Vietnam veterans, and they were all very frozen, stuck, depressed guys. And the moment they would start talking about their friends who died, they came to life. They just became full-fledged human beings. I got really very intrigued how people can get stuck on people and events that are over and that keeps them from moving on.
You write in your book about the first time you remember being drawn to study medicine. This was, I think, at summer camp. You were like 14 years old or something like that. And your cousin, as you say in the book, kept you up all night talking about how the body worked.
Glomeruli, little pieces of the kidney. Yeah.
What was it about that evening that interested you? Because you say you were just riveted by those descriptions. What was it about that made you first start to think about medicine?
It's a good thing to pick up on, because that's indeed the same thing continues to intrigue me today. And that is how incredibly intricate the human organism is. And when you look at something as simple as peeing, but how urine is made, it's just fascinating. It's excreted and reabsorbed and chemicals being interchanged and just an incredibly complex process. And if making piss is as complex as this, how much more complex is it to make thoughts, to make love, and to make human connections? And indeed, much of the work that I've done in conjunction with many, many other people in the past 40 years is to really look at how those connections are formed in the mind, in the brain, in the body, and how our experiences form them and distort them and make them grow and stuff like that. Yeah.
How were you met when you first started wanting to look into this? Was there much to go on? How new to this idea were you? And did you find, was it difficult to find colleagues that wanted to work with you? Was there a lot of skepticism about this connection that you were looking for at the time?
I've always found plenty of colleagues who want to work with me. I've always met plenty of people who saw what I saw. It was also astonishing that in psychology, psychiatry, all that, the word child abuse did not exist. The word domestic violence did not exist. The word trauma did not exist. So I'm at the VA. By this time, I am 6 years out of my training. So, you know, I'm becoming a grown-up psychiatrist. And I go to the library, and there's not a single library at the Veterans Administration talking about war trauma. It just doesn't exist. And we get the diagnosis of PTSD accepted, and the very first grant I write for the VA comes back with a rejection order that says, it has never been shown that war trauma is relevant to the mission of the Veterans Administration. And I go like, these people are crazy. So I walked into my director's office and I said, you know, I like you guys, I like working here, but the institution is more insane than the people you try to treat. It's time to go, you know, because that's just really just crazy. And so what's been astonishing to me is how reluctant people have been to realize that if you abuse and molest human beings, that really has a very bad effect on their minds and their brains. And I must say that the opposition has been dramatic. And people say, why is it? And I go, I don't get it. And that, you know, we know how bad it is, and yet people just accuse us of creating a false memory syndrome, putting memories in people's minds that were never there. And what's this resistance from just seeing that if a kid grows up in the middle of violence and molestation and poverty, that's going to mess them up. We know that. But it has been very hard for people to incorporate.
I like how you describe your teacher, Elvin Semrod, who told you that there was only one real textbook, and that was your patient. That's where you focused your work, was just on them, I guess.
Yeah, and I like to tell people regularly, don't believe what's in any textbook, including mine, because everybody has their prejudices, everybody has their cultural biases, everybody has their own stuff. And what's also striking is that our understanding of the world changes dramatically from decade to decade. And when today you read what I was taught when I was a beginning psychiatrist, it sounds like you're speaking gobbledygook. Just like it doesn't make any sense. But much of what you've written today, to me, sounds like gobbledygook also. Like cognitive treatment. Say, oh, the treatment of trauma is to point out to people how irrational their thoughts are and that they shouldn't think that way. I have tried that numerous times with my wife, for example. I always point out to her how irrational thinking is, and she's always extremely grateful that I point out the failures of her intellect. That you call that therapy, for me, is just unbelievable.
You write about how trauma, we have this area in our brain that, as you've explained it, communicates the physical embodied feeling of being alive.
Right.
Talk about that. Before we talk about how trauma compromises that, what is that? What is that part of the brain that's communicating this feeling of being alive?
Well, see, culturally, we're not there. But basically, the function of our brain is to take care of our bodies. To move to the right places, to eat at the right time, sleep at the right time, get food, get mates, all this other stuff. And so we are bodies. And on top of our body, there's this little thing called our head, our brain. And we have a place in the brain called the insula that sort of connects our mind with our bodies. And it tells you, oh, right now I feel like crap. Maybe if I get up, go for a little walk, I feel a little bit better. Or it's cold outside, and before I got out, I said, I better get a big parka on. Or so you have an internal map in your brain about where you are and where you need to go and what your body will feel like if you do that sort of stuff. And so if I tell you, let's go swim with the dolphins in Kealakekua Bay, the moment I say that, I feel my body, what it feels like to be in the salty water, and what it's like to have this, and the snow that's falling outside of my window sort of takes a back seat. So we have a very vivid awareness of our body, and that is what makes us feel alive. So certain music makes us feel good in our bodies, and certain people make us feel good in our bodies. And so these sensations in our bodies really tell us where to go. I'd like another glass of this. I'd like a little bit more of that food. Oh, I like being with that person because my body feels good with that person. So these are somatic sensations. They also are the things that warn us. Like you feel cold. I say, oh, don't go there. That person makes me feel bad and makes my heart ache and makes my gut wrench. I'm going to avoid that person. And so you get these bodily sensations that tell you that are our internal guides to the world. I'm always surprised how few people talk about it. Only people in my most intimate circle of researchers actually talk about these things, and body workers. And then when you get traumatized, it is in your body. Charles Darwin wrote a beautiful book in 1872 that everybody should read because it's just such a marvelous piece of genius. It's called The Emotional Expression of Man, Animals and Man, in which he talks that whenever something happens to the brain, you feel it in your body. Hmm. You feel it in your body, you feel it in your brain. And he talks about heartache and gut wrench. And so when you are really upset all the time, as I was, under our last president, for example, I had a chronic state of heartache and gut wrench for 4 years, almost continuously. And that's beginning to dissipate. And so you get uptight in your body. And the reason why I wanted to talk with you face to face is because talking to a screen doesn't give you that core connection. And when I see you smile, it registers in my body.
Yeah.
I like that guy. He's smiling.
Yeah.
And if I just hear your voice, you don't get the same thing. Now, when you get traumatized, if you would sit there yelling at me and putting me down, I would get gut-wrenching feelings. And so I would avoid you from that on. But if I cannot escape from you because you happen to be my boss and my paycheck depends on you, then I need to deal with you even though my heartache and my gut wrenches and what I need to do, I need to take drugs before I go to work in order to not feel so upset by you. Yeah. Or I need to go home and start drinking at night to make these feelings go away. And so the negotiation of heartache and gut wrenching involves what can I do with my body to not feel upset by it. Many people learn to just shut their bodies down. Mm. Many people stuff their bodies with food. Many people stuff their bodies with drugs to just make those feelings go away. And so the result of trauma is that you live in a body that's sort of your enemy. And what happens then is, because you sort of try to manage all these sensations in your body, it's very hard to feel pleasure. Hmm. Pleasure is also a somatic issue. Yeah. Your body feels pleasure. Huh? And you listen to a good piece of music, you start moving around. Huh? So we're somatic creatures. When we shut down our connection with our body, we shut down our connection with pleasure.
Yeah.
And when we connect down connection with our body, we stop feeling for other people. And that's what we saw so much in the sadism that we saw politically in the last 4 years, is these are people who have no relationship to their bodies. Because when a normal person sees a kid in a cage, they start crying and they start getting upset and freaked out. But somehow these people are able to see a kid in a cage and not start weeping. Or they start seeing a poor kid who's starving and say, ah, that's just a useless kid. So there's something gets disconnected from the normal human mirror neuron system that picks up other people's feelings and does something about it.
You mention in your book how people often tell you they want you to leave out the politics part when you're talking about trauma. But in the book, you write that as long as we – this is how you put it in the book – as long as we continue to live in denial and treat only trauma while ignoring its origins, we're bound to fail. You connect. You can't disconnect trauma from politics. They're connected for you.
It's stunning to me. Just last week, I posted something about – Ocasio-Cortez, and what she wrote about being haunted by people. Mm. And her account was just, that's how people feel. Their whole bodies are in a state of terror because they hear people screaming, where is the b-? And that is a sound and a sensation that stays with you. And whenever you go to certain places or you meet certain people, that feeling of where is the let's kill keeps coming into your body. You know, I posted on my blog, The Body Keeps a Score, saying, and I get more angry comments. How dare you say this? She says, so is she only? No, how dare you not say this? How dare you see the scene on Capitol Hill and pretend like that's okay to see people kill people? And to say, oh, let's leave the politics out of it. Let's just talk about other things. No, that is what is terrifying. That is what makes people, drives people crazy, to not be able to stare reality in the face. And if people say, no, if they see domestic violence and to see their parents beat each other up, and then to say, when you say to your mom, I hate dad and what he does to you, and your mom slaps you and says, dad is a wonderful man. He never hurts anybody. And you see it with your eyes that he's hurting people, and your mom says, it's not hurting people. So you say, oh, I must be wrong. I must be crazy. And so you start feeling crazy inside because your reality is different from other people's. But your body, which is very primitive and in charge of survival, will keep going. Like whenever you see that dad, you cringe or you become upset. And that's not a conscious reaction. It's your animal brain that warns you that it's happening again, even though your frontal lobe may say, no, he's just the president of the United States.
So we're, there's the rational part of the brain, and then there's the sort of more primitive part of the brain. And you, as you've talked about, we can talk about, try to rationalize until we're blue in the face. But if our primitive part of our brain perceives something as real, they're reacting to this thing, then you can't talk yourself out of it. I mean, or it's really difficult. So the talk part isn't enough in this idea of healing. We've got to embody it in a way. Is that right?
The fourth part is important because it's important to be able to tell the truth, yeah, and yes, to find language for what is going on and to put it out there so you can communicate about it. So I'm not putting down language. It's very important to say, this is what happened to me. But just telling people what happened to you is not going to make it go away. Ocasio Cortez talking about how she's traumatized by those people haunting her. It's nice that some people listen to it. But the question is, when I go to my office next time, what have people done to make sure this never happens again?
Doctor, you write about how one of your most profound experiences with healing from collective trauma was when you were seeing the work done by the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I wanted you to maybe talk about that. I'm not sure if you find any connection between what happened there, how they ground their idea for that commission through this concept of Ubuntu. I'm wondering, are you seeing any connection between what they went through and what the country right now is trying to go through? That is some sort of communal healing over the really traumatic experience over the last several years.
Well, you know, this is one of my favorite topics. What I saw in South Africa back then, of course, it all didn't work out so well, was really astonishing. As a large traumatized population who were ready to kill every white person during the transition. So it's interesting, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was not about truth and reconciliation. It is about preventing the white people of South Africa from getting killed by taking care of the rage and the pain of the black people. But the eventual beneficiaries were largely the white people who didn't get killed. And Tutu Amandela and Alex Borain and the other people were extremely conscious about it because they knew the history of India. And the moment that India was liberated, it was a slaughter that killed at least 4 million people. And that is what they expected to happen because when you get traumatized, you are angry and you want to blow up and you take revenge. So what they had to do is to calm people down. And I followed Bishop Tutu around, and it was spectacular. What would he do with people? He would sing with people. He would pray with people. They would dance together. And then people would give their testimonies, and then everybody would dance and hold each other. It was a very physical thing. Mm-hmm. A little hard to imagine in the U.S., but it reminds a little bit about what we saw after that massacre in the church in Charleston, South Carolina, and Obama went in there, and he spontaneously, and I feel like crying as I talk about it, as I did when I saw that, he starts singing Amazing Grace together. Yeah. And once you sing together, there's a comfort and a sense of belonging and a sense of safety that still exists in some places. But boy, our culture sure isn't doing very well with that.
You talk about how Western culture is, this is how you put it once, astoundingly disembodied. And you also say that we're unique in that way, we as a culture. Why is it? Why are we so caught up in not being able to embody all of this? And whereas other cultures seem to be able to, have you put your finger on it? Why can't we?
Well, you're putting me on the spot. I have to be careful here. The first word that comes to mind is capitalism, but let's not go there.
Okay.
You know, it's stunning that when you go to China, where people work as fanatically as we do and work very hard under a lot of pressure, there is dancing and singing everywhere in China. Just astonishing. You go to a park on Wednesday evening, everywhere people are doing dancing and qigong and all these things. And so the music is very alive there. It's really great to see that. Europe is doing slightly better in that regard also, particularly Spain and Italy. But, you know, when you go here and see people singing together in parks and dancing together in parks, it's just not our thing. And we are so individualistic as a sense of you are in charge of being happy, and it's not about you and your tribe. It's not you and your people. So we have taken our individualistic notions about life very far. And our biology is not an individualistic biology. Hmm. Our biology is a tribe biology. Our brain is formed in order to be a member of our tribe. Most of the parts of our brain are really about doing what you and I are doing together, yakking with each other, talking, arguing, and making things happen. That's what we have brains for, you know.
And so trauma disrupts that social engagement system, right?
It does.
Yeah.
It changes the social engagement system, and it changes your relationship to yourself. But by and large, as long as people feel loved and taken care of, they can put up with almost anything. The experience of trauma, not in the Body Keeps Score, but in the book before that, I used the word a lot, is the word of God forsaken. You're all by yourself and nobody will come and help you. And so there you are with all these feelings you have and there's nobody around. And so communality is the great answer for trauma. Feeling known, feeling seen, feeling paid attention to, feeling that your voice counts are all terribly, terribly important things. Yeah.
You know, you've talked about the experience of going down to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Hugo. Talk a little bit about what you saw, because you saw these people busily going about moving things. They were working, they were talking, they were working things out. And then the FEMA officials there said, no, stop, we need to work this stuff out first.
And that's a true story. And was it poignant? So Hurricane Hugo devastates Puerto Rico. I'm in the first plane there. Because I've written about trauma, nobody has written about trauma. So the guy must know something about trauma. Actually, I didn't know anything about trauma, but they invited me. And I go from the airport in San Juan and see the devastation all around. But people are building everywhere. The natural response to a disaster is to get together with your neighbors and your family and to rebuild. Humans are astoundingly resilient species. We do things. And natural disasters generally are okay as long as you get help to rebuild and to use your muscles and use your stress hormones to survive, to do something. Mm-hmm. Just like our snowstorms right now, we have stress hormones that dig ourselves out. And it's good to dig yourself out. And unlike people in California, who always have perfect weather, we really feel good about ourselves because we can dig ourselves out. And so what I see in Puerto Rico is people doing what we're programmed to do, is that when something bad happens, to get your 2x4, to get your tarp and get something going, get the food going and make something. And oftentimes in times of disaster, people feel very good about each other because you have a sense of purpose and sense of direction. And what happens here, which I think happens a lot in psychiatry also, is that FEMA comes in and says, well, we need to figure out what we're going to reimburse for and what we're not going to reimburse for. So stop your efforts to rebuild your houses until we have the rules for you. And while people are waiting, their stress hormones have nowhere to go and they beat each other up and have a lot of violence, because when you're upset, you need to do something.
Yeah.
We're doing creatures. And, I hope everybody has know what it feels like. If you're really taking a big effort against overwhelming odds, you feel an incredible sense of accomplishment if you can do it. But what happens in trauma is very much about immobilization, about, write about it many instances in my book, because so many people have noticed that. Freud noticed it, the old Frenchman before Freud noticed it, Pavlov knows it, and that the core issue of trauma is being unable to move, being unable to activate your fight-flight response. And so if I start yelling at you, you can say, excuse me, but I'm going to shut down the microphone, I'm going to get out of here. So you can do something. But if you cannot do something and get out or protest or fight back, then you just sit there and the stuff comes in you, and your body doesn't get activated to protect yourself. And then Joe LeDoux did that piece of research, beautiful piece of research, that shows that the circuitry in the brain becomes different and the whole memory gets laid down as a panic reaction, a reaction, as opposed to, look what I did. The fire came and destroyed my house, but within 3 days, we already had a little room where we could do the cooking.
Do you think that this pandemic is going to result in a kind of communal trauma? And one of the things that I wondered about is we've been thinking a lot about what effect is the pandemic going to have on for touch, for our ability. Like, I like shaking another person's hand.
Right.
I like getting a hug.
Right.
Even from people we don't really know, but it's this actual
shoulders, you know, just a little movement together with people.
Yeah. So what do you think is going to happen if we stop getting used to actually, yeah. I mean, you were insistent that we see each other in this conversation, right. Which I love. So yeah. what is the pandemic going to do for touch and for that connection, I wonder?
It boggles my mind. I talk to a lot of people, but I talk to people pretty well functioning, you know, and I wonder what's happening out there. You know, I think this issue of not getting in touch is devastating for people. You know, it's the irony of it all is that I've been interested in touch for a long time and touch as a therapeutic modality. And then I discovered last year that there has been actually first study came out last year, but that there has never been a study on the effect of touch and trauma. People, vision all the time, audition all the time. The whole experience of touch is basically unknown from a scientific point of view. It's just mind-boggling. I can give you all the names of all the people who have studied touch in the last 100 years, and by one hand will do.
Right.
Vision, thousands of. And so there is something about touch that's central. And what this will mean to us, it just boggles my mind. You know, I have no idea. And I think one of the things I see is that, like, I'm a very visual person. I enjoy Zooming with people. You know, I feel a connection with you. If you'd just been on the phone, I wouldn't have felt a connection with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think Zooming is going to be a very big part of our lives and will persist after the pandemic is over. And I wonder, I think it's going to reconfigure a lot of our interactions. And I'm just waiting to see.
I wonder when the White House is going to get in touch with you and say, all right, Professor or Dr. Van der Kolk, come and help us work out the communal trauma that we've all gone through because of the pandemic. Like, what kind of treatment would you propose for a country that has just spent, you know, a year and a half, 2 years in virtual isolation, coming out of this with a sense of trauma? And we need to recover. Where would you even start with such a thing?
I think I would start with a very active program of communal activities, like singing. You know, after 9/11, there was this big service in the cathedral where even George Bush got to sing and move with people. I think that's the natural response. I think, you know, what's happened, of course, is that nobody is commemorating the COVID victims. You know, I'm starting a program here where I'm living right now, and for traumatized kids, and the local hospital people say, no, we can't treat traumatized kids. Our staff is so messed up right now. Mm-hmm. We have been treating COVID for 11 months. We have seen numerous deaths. We have seen people asphyxiate, and we have stood helplessly by while people were dying by themselves. Our staff is completely messed up. And none of this has been paid attention to and celebrated. I think we need to start getting together and moving and singing and making plays and doing things where we can really acknowledge the reality of it and get people together. And usually getting together involves some sort of singing and recitation, you know, like we had at the inauguration, like we have under after disasters, people get together and make a ritual, make a liturgy. And I think every community should have a ritual fitting with where they live. You know, in Western Massachusetts, where I live, it will be different from Southern California.
Yeah. I love you write in the book about the connection between therapy and theater, and something that the actor Tina Packer told you, that therapy and theater are intuition at work. And so I like the idea of people coming together and maybe making a play as a way of healing through this experience.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, but I also see from my Facebook contact, I have a small Facebook group with former colleagues of mine and who have babies and stuff like that. A lot of the people I know are doing a lot of that dressing up and playing and acting out roles with their kids. I think well-functioning families actually do that together. And I know quite a few very well-functioning families where there's a lot of play, a lot of singing, a lot of making music, a lot of rhythmical involvement with each other. Mm. And I think the greatest danger, of course, is to sit in front of a TV or a screen and having it blast you and not take an actual role yourself. And so I think that's also worrying about the school system. If you say, would you like the White House to call you? I would like the Department of Education to call me.
Yeah, right.
That's my greatest concern, is our kids get more and more tests. You know, the number of traumatized kids in America is mind-boggling. It is well over 1 million kids and counting. And these kids cannot learn because they are too traumatized. And what did they do with these kids whose test scores keep falling because they're traumatized? Said, oh, take another exam. Work a little harder. No. Play a little bit harder. Make your body feel safe. Play basketball. Do yoga. Calm your body down. And then you can learn. When you're frightened, you cannot learn.
Yeah. One of the things you write about is how people who are traumatized should learn to, as you say, own themselves. What do you mean, own themselves?
To feel yourself. That's a... When you feel traumatized, and we all know it because we've all been there, because we all have had pain in our lives, you try to go on and ignore it. You work a little bit harder. You do something else to get away from it. But trauma treatment is about somebody giving you the courage and the company to go and to feel your feelings and to see that it's okay to have your feelings and that you... That to notice it, and to also notice that there are things you can do with your body that make you feel differently. You know, if I have any dream, it would be teaching every kid in America the four R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and self-regulation, and teach every kid from K to 12 every week what happens in the brain with self-regulation, how you can regulate yourself by breathing, you can regulate yourself by touching, you can regulate yourself by playing volleyball, and to really explore all the ways in which we can actually learn to focus, to take care of ourselves, and to feel calm. But that requires self-awareness. It requires not only doing what your teachers tell you to do, but it really also involves exploring, I feel better when I paint, but I have a very close friend who has no visual capacity. When I say to him, oh, remember when we went hiking there, he doesn't get an image in his mind of where we went hiking. So he needs other things to take care of himself. So we need to really find out what are our gifts, our capacities. So music does it for me, and visual does it for me, and other things doesn't do it for me. And for you, maybe, I like yoga. I hate Qigong. I have to try it again because I may not hate it anymore. and other people hate yoga and they love Qigong. And so we all need to find out what it is that makes us feel calm aside from drugs and porn.
Let me ask you finally, because I know we're out of time. Something you say, I've heard you say this a bit, and you say it a few times in your books, the idea that human beings are extraordinarily resilient. Yeah. And you write about how many of our most profound advances as a society and as a country came out of this experience of trauma. Yeah. And you say the great inventors and people who've been active in making social change, they all had, or many of them had, these experiences with trauma that seems like a very hopeful thing, that not only it's I guess it's necessary for us to deal with it, but advances, good things can come out of these really terrible experiences, I guess. That's a hopeful thought.
Yeah, what I would say is, and people ask me, so why do you continue to do this trauma work? And my answer is, boy, do you need meet a life force when you do trauma work? You meet people who have gone through unspeakable stuff and who are generous or productive or kind or great parents. And go like, wow, aren't people amazing that they can come out of there and do amazing things? But I also feel that as human beings, we don't learn from experience. You know, you know, you look like you're not a kid either anymore. And you know, we have seen certain phases of history, and we have seen some phases of history that very, very good things were happening. And we have seen phases of history where terrible things happen, and where terrible things become acceptable. So I'm not confident that we are in an upward swing as human beings, but at least when you do, when you study trauma, you learn a lot about what we can do to at least take care of ourselves and not be part of the problem.
Yeah. Well, Dr. van der Kolk, it's really good to see you, actually, and thank you so much for doing this.
Okay. Thank you. It was a fun interview.
Bessel van der Kolk. His book is The Body Keeps the Score. We spoke with him in February. I'm Doug Fabrizio.